So the subject of my talk is broadly dark matter and dynamical probes of dark matter in the universe. So I'll be spending a lot of time initially talking about what is dark matter. So I think this is the first talk sort of about the astrophysical nature of dark matter. So as such, you know, I'll give an introduction as, you know, as cosmologists and particle physicists and astrophysicists, why we believe in that dark matter exists. What I want to focus on too is, like, as cosmologists, we tend to sort of think about you know, dynamical probes of dark matter and dark energy on the largest possible scales that exist in the universe. Okay, so what I'm actually going to do is kind of just take this closer to home and see what we can learn about the dynamics of dark matter just by, you know, not working on, say, like, you know, 100 megaparsec-ish scales, but rather, like, you know, megaparsec-ish scales, if not even less. So in our local group in the Milky Way. So before I start, I should just say a lot of this work has been done at Irvine with my two main collaborators, James Bullock and Manoj Kaplingat. There's a few other people I've worked with here, and they'll come up here as I go along. So let me just give a brief outline of what I'm going to go over here and sort of motivations. So here, the first part here, the introduction, will be sort of my general talk, which is going to hopefully motivate you to understand why we need dark matter and why we need it in cosmology and particle physics and astrophysics. So these are sort of three independent empirical sort of beliefs and theoretical beliefs why we need dark matter and why it exists. What I'll then do is sort of review the basic dark matter models. And this, when I say basic dark matter models, these are sort of classified in the cosmological way, in the astrophysical way. So these are classified as sort of cold dark matter, warm dark matter, and there's a variance of dark matter which we've been studying recently called non-thermal dark matter. I'll explain what that is. You know, as we go along, we'll realize there's really a big job of a particle physicist and cosmologist these days is to, you know, come up with some dark matter model and then, you know, explore the astrophysical and cosmological implications of it. So, you know, this is just some subset of all the possible dark matter models that exist in the universe right now. So then I'll just kind of get into the main meat of my talk, which is going to look at astrophysical probes of the nature of dark matter. Okay, so when I say, like, the nature of dark matter, okay, so, like, how does it behave? You know, is it warm, cold, non-thermal? Like, what can we learn about from astrophysical observations that tells us about, like, what exactly is dark matter in the universe? Okay, because obviously we don't know what it is. We just deduce its effects. So some sort of novel probes that I'm going to be using here to determine the nature of dark matter are to look through sort of three particular observations. One, to look for sort of the minimum mass dark matter object that exists in the universe. Okay, so we don't really know what this is, right? There's models for it. So we're actually now in a really interesting time in observations, in astrophysical observations, where you can actually sort of probe for this minimum mass object. And of course, this is going to have implications for, you know, the nature of dark matter, cold, warm, non-thermal, et cetera. I'm also going to try to talk about learning about dark matter through the dynamics of galaxies, right? In the end, I'll kind of go through sort of indirect signals, more particle physics-type signals of dark matter. I'll end up kind of with some speculations for some sort of extremely non-standard dark matter models, which may be observable through various astrophysical observations. Okay, so let me just start off in sort of in the cosmology realm, and it's actually good. We heard the talk just before that sort of went over the basics of cosmology. So what we do here is, you know, the baseline is we assume Einstein's equations, assume the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. What do we get here? We get an equation for the expansion rate of the universe. Okay, so the expansion rate H, okay, depends on several parameters. It depends upon what stuff exists in the universe, like what kind of matter is there. Okay, so here's the Friedman equation here, and it depends upon the several parameters. So the critical density of the universe is defined as this here, okay, critical density at any given scale factor or redshift, where Z is the redshift, okay. So there's different kinds of matter in the universe, okay, so non-baryonic dark matter, okay, or just, you know, dark regular matter, or dust, that scales like 1 plus Z cubed. Radiation, you know, which is photons, neutrinos, stuff like that, scales like 1 plus z to the fourth. Cosmological constant, vacuum energy, which we've heard about, you know, just, you know, is a constant in this equation. And there's a component from curvature. Okay, so the critical density is just obtained by setting this curvature component to zero. So it's the density which makes the universe exactly flat at any given time. Okay, so in any component of the universe here, these omega sub, you know, matter, sub radiation, et cetera, sub vacuum. This just represents the density of the universe in that component divided by the critical density. Okay, so here's the sort of the standard cosmological figure. that you see when you motivate the existence of dark matter in cosmology, and you use a variety of different probes to basically understand these you know, how much of these components actually exist in the universe. Okay, so obviously way back in the early universe, the universe was radiation dominated. Okay, dominated by photons, and that the remnants of that are the cosmic microwave background. Now then we sort of transition to a period of matter domination. Okay, so now we believe we're undergoing this period of vacuum domination. Some cosmological constant term is there. So the way we see that is through a variety of observations. Several example observations are type 1a supernova. Okay, so it gives you constraints in this omega lambda, omega matter plane like this. Cosmic microwave background will give you constraints in another direction. Okay, clusters of galaxies will give you constraints in another direction. So I won't go over in details like how these are done. But basically just the point I want to make is here, these ellipses are orthogonal. They're sort of all converging on some value that says the matter density is about, you know, 0.3. Okay, omega matter is about 0.3. Okay, so what are the implications of that? So if you look at the cosmological pie, which I think came up here yesterday, so here's the dominant component of the universe, which is in the form of dark energy. Okay, so that's this guy here. So we don't, of course, know what this component is. This is dark matter. This is the matter density. This whole part of the pie here, this red and yellow, is the matter density in the universe. This yellow stuff is essentially all that is attributed to standard model particles. Okay, stuff that we're made of, in photons and neutrinos, baryons, stuff like this. The rest of this has to be some sort of dark matter that behaves like regular matter on cosmological scales. But right, we don't know what it is yet. Okay. So this is sort of the cosmological motivations for dark matter. So let me just have a quick slide here about what is the sort of particle physics motivations for dark matter. Okay. So if you sort of go to any sort of regular standard extension to the standard model of particle physics, like supersymmetry, say universal X dimensions, something like this, you see the presence of weakly interacting massive particles, mass about 100 GeV. Okay. So back in the early universe, what happened was the universe was hot and dense earlier on. And all particles were essentially in equilibrium with one another. Okay, what I say in equilibrium in this context is interactions. So say if you have some random dark matter particle, like which I'm going to call chi here, those could, you know, create and annihilate to say any sort of standard model fermions, at will. Okay, when the temperature of the universe is high enough. Okay, eventually what happens? The temperature of the universe decreases. Okay, this the interaction, say from some standard model particle back to dark matter particle is going to freeze out. Okay, that's actually not going to happen because the temperature is too low. But this reaction is still efficient. So what's happening is these particles are getting depleted exponentially. Okay, so this is essentially time that's going along here on this axis here, and this is the number density of those dark matter particles. So eventually what happens then is like this interaction goes this way to the right, but eventually, you know, the temperature gets low enough, and the interaction to the right eventually freezes out, and you're left with some relic abundance of dark matter particles in the universe. Okay. So the relic abundance here is, you know, what's called omega sub chi. That's essentially how many dark matter particles exist. And that's a function of essentially 1 over the annihilation cross-section times the relative velocity. Okay, so this is a rough scaling here. So basically what it tells you is the more efficiently a particle is annihilated in the early universe, the lower its relic abundance is going to be. Okay. So there's a coincidence scale here which sort of motivates the existence of dark matter, both from particle physics and cosmology. And says the mass of some particle which has regular electroweak scale, which is required for electroweak symmetry breaking, has a mass of about 100 GeV and sort of has sort of standard weak interaction type of things, gives you the right amount of relic abundance for dark matter. Okay. So this is sort of the motivations why we believe particle physics gives us good models for dark matter. Okay. So I've sort of handled the cosmology, particle physics. Now I want to give one more thing, and that's look at the astrophysics, basically. Okay, so astrophysics is actually ultimately where dark matter was first discovered, right? So here's a couple of cartoons. When you look at galaxies, right? Galaxies of the universe are, of course, very diverse. They come in many shapes and sizes. So here's a galaxy like the Milky Way, which has a disk and it rotates. And if what you do is if you just, you know, take simple Newtonian dynamics and calculate the rotation curve of the Milky Way, okay? And you attribute and you calculate just what the rotation speed of a star is at any given radius, okay, just due to the amount of matter you see, okay, you're going to get some rotation curve that falls off like that, obviously, because there's no matter out here, okay. But that's actually not what's observed. You observe the rotation speed of stars in the galaxy, sort of in the outer regions. You measure a rotation curve that flattens out, okay. So basically, what does that tell you? Okay, it tells you that, one, either your law of gravity is wrong, okay? Newton's laws are wrong, which I'm not going to really get into that during this talk. Or two, there's just some unseen matter that exists that's forcing this galaxy to rotate at such high speeds. Okay, so essentially what happens is, so how this is defined is you've got a galaxy that's sitting in here, and you've got a huge dark matter halo, as it's called, okay, that's sitting all around it. Okay, so basically what happens here is this galaxy is believed to be sitting in an enormous halo of dark matter. Okay, so that's a kind of rotating galaxy. There's also many other kind of galaxies in the universe, non-rotating galaxies. So here's an example of a galaxy. See, these are just background stars here. And you can also deduce, so some these galaxies don't rotate, but you can deduce the existence of dark matter just by looking at the velocity dispersions of the stars in the system. Okay, and what you do is you calculate the velocity dispersion. You just go through regular sort of dynamical equilibrium analysis, and you say, okay, I don't have enough matter in stars. I don't have enough mass in stars to account for with the velocity dispersion of that system. Therefore, I must have some sort of dark matter. Okay, so these observations here kind of go back to the 1930s, right? Zwicky. Later on, Vera Rubin measured the rotation speed for the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the closest to the Milky Way. But so this is really sort of, essentially hands-on proof, and this is where the existence of dark matter first came from. And ultimately, this is going to be kind of the focus of my talk here, understanding the nature of dark matter through these types of observations. Okay, so given sort of a particle physics model and given sort of a motivated model for dark matter, what can we learn from these types of observations? Okay, so hopefully what I'm going to try to convince you is now is an interesting time to be doing these observations based upon new observations that are coming in sort of just within the past few years. Okay, so what I want to kind of start with here is I want to go over sort of some standard dark matter models, okay, and sort of, classify them once again as cold, warm, and non-thermal, and, sort of speculate on a variety of other causes. Okay, so the standard picture of dark matter is that it's cold, okay, so the freeze-out figure that I showed earlier, the dark matter sort of froze out, when the ratio of the mass to the temperature was about 20. Okay, so that means it was much that the particle froze out in the early universe sort of with negligible sort of relic thermal velocity. Okay, so the velocities of the particles actually don't affect any dynamics of the observed systems. Okay, so those actually turn out to be the easiest kind of dark matter models to simulate. And we actually run numerical simulations of sort of in a cosmological type volume of a dark matter particle like this. You start out with some sort of seed initial fluctuations that were believed to be generated by inflation in some way, and then you evolve, dark matter, and then you evolve the model forward, and what you get is you get a bunch of dark matter substructure, and you get a bunch of things that look like galaxies in the universe. And if you sort of zone in on what you think looks like a Milky Way type of galaxy, you'll get something like this. This is just like a gravitational simulation, watching things kind of come together in an expanding universe. So basically, you kind of have a Milky Way type galaxy sitting in here, right? There's believed to be a disk that's sitting in here, but it's harder to simulate the disk, so you don't really understand what's going on there. But this is just dark matter only. What's the prediction of cold dark matter you see, though? You see many sort of these satellite systems that are swimming around, okay? So these things are not just one particle themselves. They're like many, many particles that have come together. And these are believed to be in some ways associated with galaxies around the Milky Way. Okay, so you can make this a little more quantitative and say, if you look at any sort of random numerical simulation and you count the number of halos, so basically a proxy for the halos is its maximum circular velocity. Okay, so just do regular Newtonian dynamics, calculate the maximum circular velocity of any given dark matter halo, and you count the number that you see in the numerical simulations, and these dark matter, these little objects here are sort of called subhalos because they sort of reside like in a bigger dark matter halo. Okay. So this is kind of what you see right here. So these are just errors from the scatters and the simulations. Okay. What you observe in the Milky Way actually is something quite different. Okay. You observe, say, at maximum circular velocities of 10, you instead of observing, say, hundreds like you see these dark matter objects in numerical simulations, you only see like 10 or so galaxies running around in the Milky Way. Okay. So the question is, is this a problem for cold dark matter, right? Does this mean that cold dark matter is not the true picture of the universe, right? Does this mean dark matter behaves differently? Does this mean there's some galaxy formation processes that we don't understand that's going into this? So it might be a combination of both, and eventually I'll kind of get on to like answering this question. But a lot of what people kind of use this for is they use it as a springboard to kind of look at alternative dark matter models, okay? And see, can I make models that actually look more like the observed universe just by twiddling with the properties of dark matter? Okay, so I'll kind of get into that. sort of, this is one sort of dynamical prediction of the standard cold dark matter. Okay, so what's the second sort of dynamical prediction? And that's if you look at not just say the whole galaxy itself and it's just its structure around it, but if you look at like one individual galaxy, okay, so what is the density, what's essentially a density profile of that galaxy? Okay, so once again, numerical simulations have been done. It's not really understood exactly analytically why this is true yet, but it's found that if you run simulations of standard cold dark matter, the density profile scales like 1 over r in the central regions, and those are called cusps. Okay, so that's sort of the standard terminology for this. A way to kind of physically understand it is this cold dark matter has very large phase space density, okay, which is essentially defined as the physical density divided by the velocity dispersion cubed. Okay, so this is going to be a very large number, and I'll compare this to warm dark matter models, which have much smaller values of phase space density. But essentially, like, you're not reaching a phase space limit because cold dark matter has lots of particles. Like, if you just take a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, cold dark matter has lots of particles sort of in the low phase space density regime. Okay, so then it can all kind of like pack towards the center of a dark matter halo. Okay, so that's essentially what's going on here. the question is, does this look like observations? And the answer is, you know, not really. Okay, so if you look at sort of low mass dark matter halos that are believed to be mostly dominated by dark matter and not dominated by stars, you get a variety of different results. You'll get some halos that are fit well by a cusp. Okay, so here's essentially, these points are essentially the rotation curve. This is, you know, the rotation curve versus radius. This is the velocity you attribute, you just measure. Okay, so you just measure the rotation speed, and this is the velocity you measure. Then you have to subtract out some region that you think that comes from the stars. Okay, some velocity that comes from the stars, and then you kind of get something like this. And this is the velocity attributable just to the dark matter itself. And you do several fits here, like these authors have done, and you find that, you know, some are well fit by a cusp, other are well fit by what's called a core, which essentially means that the density profile comes up, you know, or it decreases in the outer region, but towards the center it actually reaches a flat region. It becomes flat, right? Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
Because of the prediction of a cusp, you would expect most galaxies are dark matter dominated all the way in. Mm-hmm. And they therefore claim that this is not a small issue, this is a systematic issue.
What I would say, like, I would say it's not necessarily a matter of, like, what's the inner density, what they're saying. So they said when they were fitting to Mond, they're saying there's some acceleration scale, right?
And the acceleration scale picks a radius for each galaxy. And,
yeah.
And the idea is that within that radius, for essentially every galaxy that's been studied, you need neither a modification of Newtonian dynamics nor dark matter to fit the rotation curves.
You need neither one.
Neither one. That is.
Okay, I'm unaware of this claim actually. I'm unaware of the claim that you need neither one. I've heard the claim that you. So basically, what you might be saying is there's systematic issues in the observations that don't give you that, you know, don't necessarily rule out cold dark matter. Is that what you're saying?
The claim is the specific claim is that a feature of the observed rotation curves is that they're fit by Newtonian gravity with baryonic matter within some radius for every galaxy.
Right. Well, Lee, so you're just saying that the core, the center of galaxies, is baryon dominated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees on that.
But the center of Milky Way type galaxies are baryon dominated. This, like, when we're looking at these type of systems, we're looking at galaxies that are believed to be complete dark matter dominated. They're extremely, they have low luminosities and stars. These are extremely low surface brightness.
They make the claim also for low surface brightness galaxies.
Yeah, so Mond initially came. I mean, it was invented sort of fit the rotation curve for low surface brightness galaxies.
No, that's not true. Milgram's paper was before there were low surface brightness galaxies, before there were any rotation curves from low surface brightness galaxies. I'm not saying this to defend Mond, but just to clarify the record, that Milgram made a prediction for low surface brightness galaxies in 83 at a time when there were no rotation curves known for low surface brightness galaxies.
Okay.
So that's claimed as a success.
But you can't fit that over, like, all, so you could fit, so he, for Mond case, you can fit rotation curves over sort of like a particular region of mass of a galaxy. but say for like extremely low luminosity galaxies that actually don't rotate, right? Or like clusters of galaxies. Right. Mon, that's not well described by Mon. So Mon's like, you know, it's essentially an empirical formula which works, you know, in this small
I'm not making this convention to defend Mon, but, okay. but there's a particular issue that they raise regarding the cusps, and I'm interested in how serious you think it is.
I'm actually not aware of this argument. I don't know, I just don't understand what the argument is. Maybe we can get back to it at some point. I'd be happy to listen to it though. Understand what's going on. So, yeah, so anyway, of course, like, you know, there's systematic errors as far as measuring the central densities of galaxies, even when you look at low surface brightness cases. So, but, and that sort of, like, lets the theorists to kind of come along and speculate, you know, maybe there's something wrong with the astrophysics. Maybe, you know, it's not astrophysical, but it's actually something intrinsic in the nature of dark matter that we don't understand. Okay, maybe dark matter is not cold. And that's actually sort of led to the sort of standard alternative to cold dark matter is a so-called warm dark matter, okay? So warm dark matter is sort of like, you can think of, when you think of warm dark matter, think of something like a standard sort of neutrino type of particle, okay? Which it doesn't freeze out, you know, with non-relativistic velocities in the early universe. It freezes out, you know, with the velocities or, you know, they affect the dynamics of this, they would affect the dynamics of the growth of structure in galaxies, okay? So they'd freeze out with, say, m over t approximately equal to 1, okay? So there you go, freezes out with non-negligible thermal velocities. So basically, this has two effects on the formation of structure in the universe. One, you know, the neutrinos, right, they have large velocities, so they're not actually going to be able to clump into small dark matter halos, okay? They're going to so-called free stream out of dark matter halos, okay, and not make small halos in the universe, okay? So that could be like a question of why aren't we seeing any small halos in the universe? Maybe they just, like, don't exist, okay? So the interesting thing about this is there's strong cosmological bounds on mass of neutrino-like particles, which gives a lower bound on the mass based upon, you know, observations of the power spectrum of galaxies in the universe. Okay, so this is essentially a power spectrum, which is essentially the correlation function of galaxies, which is Fourier transform here. And this K here is just the Fourier transform of the co-moving wave number. So smaller scales go off to the right here, larger scales go off to the left. So, you know, this is all, you know, fantastic cosmological data which has been taken, okay? So, you know, the effect, so for a standard cold dark matter like power spectrum, you get something like this, okay, that runs all the way down here. You know, for neutrino type models, depending on the mass, you'll get various degrees of suppression of the small scale power spectrum in this regime here. Okay, so this, you know, this, basically this inner curve here is just distinguished from, say, something in the middle by different mass, okay? So, you know, as you can kind of see here, like, we're not allowed to have too much free streaming if we want to agree with these observations. Okay. So, and this analysis has actually come along just within the past few years here, and ever since 05, there's actually been stronger limits even than this that have been put on sterile neutrinos that claim that the mass has got to be greater than about, say, 10 keV. Okay. It might be subject to some systematics, but still, you know, the point is here, like, we're putting sort of a strong lower bound on these particles based upon these arguments. Okay, so there's another effect of warm dark matter, which is, you know, in principle physically separate, okay, than free streaming, and that's once again these phase space arguments. Okay, so I told you before, CDM has high phase space density because it's got a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution and got a large fraction of its particles, or, you know, have low phase space density. A neutrino-like particle will freeze out with a Fermi-Dirac distribution, okay, and it has a higher fraction of its particles have high, a larger fraction of its particles have high phase space density. Okay, so, you know, once again, this is quantified in this Q term here. So kind of these are just funny astronomical units that are used because this is the way that you can most easily compare observations, as I'll show in this figure here. But so remember the coefficient here for CDM was like 10 to the 14. For warm dark matter, this is just for standard sort of neutrino-like particle. Its phase-based density is 10 to the minus 4, okay, in these units. Okay, so it's much lower than cold dark matter. And this is just, you can just easily calculate this just from what the distribution function is for each type of particle. Okay, so this is really easy to calculate. So, you know, we want to eventually compare this to observations. Okay, this is a fine-grained phase-based density. Okay, we want to compare this to observations where we measure actually the coarse-grained phase-based density, right? We don't measure individual dark matter particles. We measure just the coarse-grained density. So this is quantified here in terms of what's the velocity dispersion of a given galaxy. So, okay, so this is, you know, measuring the phase-based density of various galaxies versus velocity dispersion. And so here's clusters of galaxies here, you know, have high velocity dispersion and low phase-based density observed. You know, here's some sort of spiral galaxies, Milky Way type galaxies sitting here. Here's some low surface brightness galaxies. And basically, here are the most dark matter dominated galaxies in the universe right here. And these are the satellite galaxies around the Milky Way. Okay. So these have phase space densities of about 10 to the minus 4 or so. Okay. So basically, based upon the properties of this, when you coarse, so when you take a fine grain phase space density and you coarse grain, essentially what happens is Q reduces. Okay. So basically, if you have a particle physics model that you predict, say, Q of 10 to the minus 8 in these units, and you measure dark matter halos that have coarse grain phase space density above that, then you can, you know, reasonably say that that model is ruled out. Okay, so this is not exact. This is not exactly a theorem, but it's close enough here to sort of get what the physics is going on. So this is basically one way of constraining the nature of dark matter by looking at sort of small dark matter halos. Okay, so you know, once it, the implicit assumption I'm making here is that the dynamics of these small galaxies are actually set by dark matter physics. Okay, and they're not maybe set by maybe something that happened with the stars or the baryons in the early universe, okay, that we, you know, don't really understand yet. You know, we think this is a pretty good approximation because, you know, once again, these galaxies are extremely dark matter dominated, and there's no known process that actually can, you know, destroy, you know, change, say, like a cusp type structure to a core type structure in these type of galaxies, okay, in these small systems. Okay, so you know, in these galaxies here are going to be kind of the focus of the majority of my talk. Okay, trying to understand the nature of dark matter by looking at these guys here. Okay, so before I do that, I would just want to give sort of one more dark matter model that that predicts maybe a different structure for dark matter halos. And you know, I want to consider, like I said, a non-thermal dark matter model. So before I go into that, you know, like I said, this is sort of a standard job of a particle theorist and a cosmologist to sort of invent some dark matter scenario and see how it tests and see how it compares to observations. You know, several sort of models have been looked at, you know, dark matter that actually self-interacts with itself. You know, as opposed to being completely dissipationless, dark matter that actually self-annihilates via strong interactions, you know, completely decaying dark matter that decays into nothing else, but say standard monoparticles and no dark matter particles. So what I actually want to just talk about here is non-thermal dark matter, because this is kind of a well-motivated scenario in the context of supersymmetry and universal extra dimensions and some of the you know, standard extensions to the standard model. So basically what happens here is you have a dark matter particle instead of like a standard sort of neutralino type particle, that's the actual dark matter today, you have a super weakly interacting particle, which is something like a gravitino. Okay, so what happens here is the neutralino is created in the early universe. It goes kind of through the standard freeze-out process, you know, sometime maybe after Big Bang nucleosynthesis or much, much later even, okay, it actually decays to become a gravitino. Okay, so you know, there's a gravitational interaction between those two particles, which is why the decay rate is suppressed and it's so long. So the decay rate in these models can be anywhere from 10 to the 4 seconds to 10 to the 8 seconds, or even actually much, much larger. Okay. So, you know, what do we have here? You know, we have a super weakly interacting particle, which is a gravitino, say. It's nothing you're actually ever going to detect directly in a laboratory, you know. But what happens is you might be able to detect it cosmologically because it has a large velocity when it's produced. Okay, it gets a large kick, right, in the decay. Okay. So ultimately, what that means is there's a suppression of the power spectrum once again. You know, small mass galaxies aren't believed to exist, and it has a small phase space density. Okay, the phase space density depends upon a little bit different combination of parameters. Depends upon when the thing decays, and say what's the kinematics of the decay, what's the mass difference. But you know, once again, you kind of get this 10 to the minus 6 number. And in other words, this is often plotted in this parameter space of the mass of what's called the super WIMP, which is the gravitino, and the mass difference between, say, the gravitino and the next to lightest particle. Okay, so you know, once again, you can kind of carve out your ideal region of the parameter space that has Q values that are consistent with being observed, and has free streaming lengths that are consistent with being observed. Okay, so this is non-thermal in the sense that, you know, the dark matter today was not actually ever, you know, was not the thing that froze out, right, through the standard sort of arguments. Okay, so basically, so this is kind of some motivation for, you know, they're definitely different flavors of dark matter, and they're motivated by different, you know, many different regions, many different ways. And what I want to kind of do now is sort of transition to the astrophysics and see, you know, look at those small galaxies in the universe and see if we can actually do anything to distinguish these types of models. Okay, so, yeah, go.
When are these decaying? Are we thinking like really high redshift?
They can actually decay a little bit after BBN time, before BBN time. They can actually decay, you know, today, right? These particular things actually do not. You know, basically what you have to do is if you want something to decay really late in the universe, you got to sort of fine-tune, you know, what the mass difference can be because you got to make sort of other astrophysical bounds. And actually, I'll talk about some of the astrophysical bounds at the end when I sort of speculate on some crazy dark matter models.
Okay.
Not crazy, but let's say speculative. there are some dark matter models you can say are crazy, actually. So anyway, so let's sort of look, you know, at galaxies now. So I showed you the picture of, you know, the simulations of a Milky Way-sized galaxy. So what about observations, actually? So I showed that flat curve, which is observations, and that was sort of circa, you know, maybe 2003-ish. Okay. So in the past couple of years, actually, our understanding of the population of galaxies that surround the Milky Way has actually, you know, undergone a dramatic transformation. Okay, and the reason for that is, you know, as I'll show in the next slide, is we have now the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is able to detect stellar systems of extremely low surface brightness. Okay, so here's kind of the old population of dwarf galaxies, which I showed in that flat line earlier. Okay, and you know, they were discovered any kind of a random conglomeration of times up to 2004. These are actually these are the most dark matter dominated systems right here. Okay, extremely low luminosity. These actually don't rotate. These are kind of what I'm going to be focusing on. These guys here are much lower luminosity than even these guys. Okay, so to give you sort of a, you know, point of reference, these guys are about 10 to the 7 times the luminosity of the sun. These guys anywhere from, say, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 5 times the luminosity of the sun. So the question, you know, I'm going to ask is, like, are these actually, what kind of dark matter halos are these sitting in? Okay, and if we understand what kind of dark matter halos that these are sitting in, can we actually, you know, use that to, like, understand the nature of dark matter in some way? So to kind of just get at the general picture of what you look at when you look at sort of satellite systems in the Milky Way. Well, okay, so this is an astronomical figure, so obviously they make it as confusing as possible, but essentially this is a higher luminosities go up. This is more luminous systems go this way, so, you know, magnitude goes down for whatever reason. Bigger size of the system goes this way. Okay, so these are all sort of satellite systems in the Milky Way, satellite stellar systems. So these are globular clusters, okay? So these, you know, there's about 100 or so globular clusters that observe orbit the Milky Way, and they you know, span, you know, many orders of magnitude in luminosity. The globular clusters are believed to be just, there's no evidence for the presence of dark matter in globular clusters, okay? Essentially, when you sort of do the dynamical fits and you account for the motion of the stars in the system just by the mass of the stars you see, there's really no need for dark matter. Okay. As you can see, these globular clusters kind of extend about, you know, maybe this is a half light radius. So basically, it's the radius in which half the light is coming from. So they extend maybe about 100 parsecs or so. Okay. These guys here are that's the population of dark matter dominated dwarf galaxies that I hit up earlier in the previous slide. Okay. You know, there's 10 or so of these that are orbiting the Milky Way. And these guys, you know, I mean, the interesting thing is, like, these guys all kind of have the same velocity dispersion when you take the velocity dispersion of their system, right? They don't rotate. They have the same velocity dispersion, but, you know, these things are much more extended. And basically what that ultimately means is, you know, for a fixed luminosity, same velocity dispersion, you know, much more extended means this thing has to have, you have to have some sort of dark matter sitting in these systems. Okay, and I'll show that in a second. I'll convince you of that. So this is the old population here, and, you know, ever since the new survey of Sloan has come along, you know, here's the new ones that we detected, actually. Okay, kind of sitting right here, and these are just, you know, lines. This is basically why Sloan is detected, because you have a surface brightness of a system here, you know, below this, you know, that's where they could actually detect new things. Okay, so these are all the new galaxies that have been discovered by Sloan. And what you'll kind of notice here is, like, there's a gap, right? And, you know, this gap was kind of longstanding to believe the distinction between globular cluster and a dwarf galaxy. You know, kind of at this lower luminosity, for some reason that, you know, no one's really sure yet, we're actually detecting things down here. Okay, so basically, you know, what I'm going to really focusing on is, are these actually globular clusters, or are they dwarf galaxies? And the only way you can answer that is basically try to figure out if there's dark matter sitting in them. Okay. Okay, so, you know, I told you that these things do have dark matter. Here's basically the convincing slide that they do. So, you know, the data is actually getting much, much better. So these are sort of the old, sort of well-known luminous satellite systems, and these just kind of go by different names here. You know, here's the velocity dispersion as a function of radius. Okay, so this is essentially what you use to measure the mass of the galaxy. Okay, so the velocity dispersion, you know, these things once again extend, these things extend about, you know, kiloparsec or so. So these fits here, right? All these dotted curves are just assuming that you have no dark matter, and you just have mass that comes from the stars. So these are the best fits in all those cases. Okay, these things are now if you include dark matter. Okay, all these solid curves. Okay, so basically this is sort of evidence that, you know, if you sort of do this, and this is just obtained just from a sort of standard, you know, physics 101 equilibrium dynamical analysis of these systems. Okay, just equilibrium genes equations. Okay, so so basically what you say is like these have to be dark matter dominated, and it turns out that the ratio of the mass in dark matter to the mass of stars of all these systems turns out to be about maybe anywhere from 10 to 1,000 in some cases. Okay, so some of these guys are extremely dark matter dominated. Okay, so of course, you know, we can only see galaxies like this in the local neighborhood because they're extremely faint, and presumably like these galaxies exist, you know, all around the universe as well. Okay, so, you know, once again, what I want to do is like focus on if we can actually use these, you know, to probe what the nature of dark matter is in these systems. Okay, given that we know that it exists here. Okay, so, you know, what we need ultimately, if we want to really make the best possible constraints, is we need like some dynamical probe of the mass. We need like to know like what the best observational proxy is of these systems. Okay, where do I best measure the mass of these systems? And this is sort of just can easily be done, you know, once again, by doing a standard equilibrium analysis. So here's essentially what, if you just measure the distribution of stars in one of these galaxies, this is what you get. You know, so it turned out the best place to measure the mass of these systems, you know, doing this equilibrium analysis, comes at about 2 times the so-called King radius here. So here's how the King radius. So basically the King radius fitting this data to a curve like this. Okay, and all these galaxies can be seen to be fit to a curve like this. Okay, so basically where you want to measure the mass is at about 2 times this radius, so maybe something like around here. So, okay. So that's where the best possible constraints come from, and you can get an error of about 20% on the mass, you know, just with sort of regular, just by measuring the velocities of a couple hundred stars in these systems. Okay, so you know, when you do that, what happens? You get really like an interesting result, which is a result we're just actually going to publish here in a bit. You know, you can kind of, instead of making a velocity function, you can make a mass function of these systems. Okay. So you measure the mass, so the average King radius for these systems is something like 0.3 kiloparsecs. Okay, so you measure the mass of all these guys, and you basically just construct the mass function very simply. What do you get here? You get them all kind of conglomerating around one mass. Okay, so remember I told you that the luminosities spread like a large range, okay, anywhere from say 10, you know, 1,000 times the sun to 10 to the 7 times the sun in their luminosities. So what appears to be happening is their dark matter masses are all, you know, sort of converging around the same mass. Okay, so here's the figure to show that here. You know, the same mass within about 0.3 kiloparsecs turns out to be about 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 solar masses. Okay, and this is basically independent over like 4 decades of luminosity. Okay, so here's the newer systems here. These, you know, have the samples are not, they're not as well measured, which is why their error bars are a little bit bigger. But you know, the point is here, look at how slowly this evolves over this whole luminosity range. Okay, so the question is like, what is this telling us? Is this telling us something fundamental about the nature of dark matter, right? Or is this maybe telling us something about like how stars, you know, in baryons sort of clump into halos and make those dark matter halos? So what you can actually do is you can do an analysis like we did before and look at sort of the numerical simulations of cold dark matter, just dark matter only, because once again, it's really hard to simulate dynamics of baryons on these small scales. And you get like, you can get a mass function that looks like this if you look at the entire dark matter subhalo population, which, you know, steeply rises over this mass range. Okay, so here's the observed system. Here's the mass function of the observed ones, which you just obtain simply from here, just, you know, by counting the number per mass bin. Okay. And what you can say is like, if this is consistent with the cold dark matter story, then basically these two curves are essentially the earliest forming dark matter halos in the universe. Okay. So basically what happens is like, you know, if you believe that CDM is true, then the population that we're seeing is just, they're probably just the earliest things that formed in the universe. Okay. And there's physical arguments why that can possibly be true. I can get into that later, but you know, so the point I want to get across here is like, we're not necessarily ruling out cold dark matter because of this story. Okay. Okay. This is ultimately going to depend upon complex modeling and sort of how galaxies form in the universe. But you know, one thing I want to kind of throw out and speculate on is, you know, why is this characteristic mass there? Okay. Could this possibly be explained by dark matter? One possible solution is there's no halos that exist below this mass scale in the universe. Okay. So there's no other option. Like, however, you know, luminous your stellar system is, like that's it. You know, you've got no choice but to live in this halo. Okay. So anyway, so this is, you know, sort of the first bullet point of you know, what I was talking about, the dynamics of probing, like, what's the minimum mass dark matter halo that exists? Okay. Could this be it? And this is a question we may be able to ask observationally now. Okay, so this is this sort of this ends sort of that portion, and I want to spend the last I guess 15 minutes or so. Do I have 15 minutes? I forgot when I started. Okay. 5 minutes. Okay, so what I want to do is I just want to spend a little more time talking about not numbers, but I want to spend talking about this core cusp issue again, and then maybe speculating about some ways to indirectly detect dark matter in the end. Okay, and I hope I can do that in 5 minutes. So this is all dependent upon, this all is, you know, based upon, once again, numbers of satellite galaxies. So, you know, what I want to say is, when you look at these dark matter dominated galaxies, you know, cores and cusps are not distinguishable in these systems. Okay, so don't focus on this part, on the left hand side, just focus on the right hand side for now. So here's some data for these systems, and as you can kind of easily see here, you know, you have a core model, right, which has a flat density in the center, and you have a cusp model, which has a steep density in the center, and you know, the data is really never actually going to ever be able to distinguish between these two systems if you just have this kind of data that exists, okay, which is just measuring the radial velocities of stars, you know, their motion for to and away from you. Okay, so the question is, can you ever actually do something about that? And can you ever actually measure a core or cusp in these systems? And the question is, you actually can if you don't focus on just the radial velocity of the system, but if you focus on the transverse velocities, or so-called proper motions. Okay, this is as they're called in astronomy. And the way that you can actually see that is, so here's essentially just, you know, the simple integral when you calculate the line of sight velocity dispersion of these systems. And this is a standard way to do it. Depends upon several factors, including what's the density of stars that exist. You know, this is the two-dimensional density, this is the three-dimensional density, and here's where the gravitational potential comes in, which is through the three-dimensional velocity dispersion of the system, okay, not the projected one. So, I mean, all these factors are the same when you calculate the velocity dispersion in any direction, okay, so the you know, this line of sight direction is coming out of you. So the point is, like, you get, when you include these components, you get a different linear combination of this beta factor. And beta is essentially the velocity anisotropy of the stars in the system. Okay, it's the ratio of the radial velocity dispersion to the three-dimensional velocity dispersion. Okay, so the question is, can you actually measure this? And basically, what you need is, you know, you need errors that are similar to the current measurements of line of sight velocities, about 5 kilometers per second. And for galaxies at a typical distance of these guys, about 100 kiloparsecs, this corresponds to an accuracy about 10 microarcseconds per year. Okay. So, you know, we do have an experiment which could potentially do that. I won't go into the details, which is called SIM, which may or may not actually exist. But, you know, I just want to just set some scales here. This is how good we can currently measure proper motions with the Hubble Space Telescope with this guy. And this is how good SIM would actually be able to measure it. So, you know, big leap by orders of magnitude if they could actually do this. You know, and we think this is interesting because they can actually use it to probe the nature of dark matter. Okay, SIM is actually something that's been talked about in the context of finding extrasolar planets. Because it can measure, say, wobbles of stars due to the potential, due to the influence of a planet nearby that you actually can't directly detect. But anyway, so the point is here, you know, once again, you know, you can constrain a cusp model and a core model to about 20%, you know, at about 2 times the King core radius, you know, if you use proper motions as well. Okay, so another way to actually see this is, like, you know, just this degeneracy plane between beta, which is, once again, the velocity anisotropy parameter. This is a big degeneracy parameter as a function of the logarithmic slope of the density profile around this region. Okay, and you know, you have a cusp model with just regular measurements, and then you have something with proper motions, right, which you can clearly measure. And the point is, can you distinguish something like this from something like this, the core from the cusp? And basically, you can. Okay, this is actually good enough in a lot of cases to distinguish, say, like a cold dark matter model from a warm dark matter model. Okay, and there's really only a couple hundred stars that you're actually going to need to measure with SIMS. Essentially, it's sort of dynamical probes of, like, the nature of dark matter. Okay, so if this measurement could be actually made, you know, this story could ultimately be settled, you know, whether we have cores or cusps that exist in these systems, and, you know, learn about how the dark matter is actually behaving. So I think I have a couple more minutes now, so that was phase two real quickly, and what I'm going to do is phase three is sort of indirect detection of some dark matter models. So my last couple of slides here, I'll just talk about, like, how do you indirectly detect dark matter? And what I mean indirectly is, I say, like, you have dark matter particles like this guy, neutralino, and they annihilate through some diagrams to ultimately, say, high energy photons. Okay, so this is, of course, a very model dependent thing about what the spectrum of photons is that come out. You know, you get contributions from continuum emissions, which come from pion decays to photons. You know, ultimately you go, you know, neutralino, quark, and then, you know, pi zero, and then photons ultimately. You have loops which contribute to this, you know, direct annihilation into photons, which you see lines, but these tend to be more suppressed because they're loop diagrams, obviously. And what this flux actually depends upon, it depends upon particle physics right here. What's the spectrum? Well, basically, what's this stuff here? What's going on here? What's the spectrum of photons that come out? And what's the density of the galaxy? Okay, so that's the astrophysics here. So you need two factors actually here to determine this. Basically, you know, what are the main places you can actually look for this signal? Well, there's two places. You can look in the center of the galaxy, or you can look in one of these sort of dark matter dominated dwarf galaxies. Okay, so the center of the galaxy actually turns out to be an enormous mess because there's a black hole sitting in there, obviously, and there's an astrophysical point source that's emitting radiation in exactly this energy regime. So that's actually going to be a tough signal to track because, you know, you've got these backgrounds. And so here's two examples of a, you know, minimum supersymmetric standard model, Kaluza-Klein dark matter, you know, that it would kind of fit to these. But, you know, once again, we have backgrounds. We don't really know how to deal with those in the center of the galaxy. Another possibility is to look at these satellite galaxies when we actually know how to measure the mass really well, actually, now, right? And so here's a variety of different models, you know, contribution from lines, contribution from continuum sources. And here's, you know, what the backgrounds are there. Okay, so ultimately, you're going to have to subtract backgrounds in some way. Here's the thing is, there's just a booming background here. And you might actually hear about this in the next year or so because GLAST is actually going to launch in 2007. And actually, one of its main missions is going to be try to detect indirect dark matter. This is actually not the only way you can detect dark matter. You can actually speculate, you know, going back to those super weakly interacting dark matter models, you can actually say, are dark matter particles stable? Okay, they don't have to be stable, right? You know, what could happen is you could have a decay like this, you know, and this mass splitting between these two particles, you know, in principle could be arbitrarily small. Okay, and if this mass splitting is arbitrarily small, then you once again you'll have a contribution to the diffuse photon background. So here's a plot of the diffuse photon background as a function of a large number of energies. You know, and you can actually look in this background for signals such as this. Okay, so you know, nothing requires that WIMPs be stable. Okay, so these are possible signals you can look for. And in my last couple of slides here, I want to, you know, sort of continue along those lines. And sort of one of the more speculative things that people talked about in dark matter recently is this 511 keV signal from the galactic center. Okay, so what happens here? Here's a map of the galactic center in terms of 511 keV photons. And what you see here is you've got this enormous source that's sitting right here, and it's extremely smooth. Okay, so this is the most recent measurement from this integral satellite that's actually done this. You know, previous satellites had measured this. You know, it wasn't exactly smooth like this due to the resolution issues. But now it's like this extremely smooth emission from the center of the galaxy. Okay, so the question is this astrophysical? Well, the point is there's really no known astrophysical source that actually that can do this. Okay, the sources either they're not distributed in the center of the galaxy correctly, or the rate at which they emit positrons, which is ultimately causing this 511 keV photon line to happen. You have positrons which are annihilating with ambient electrons. Okay, so something's got to be creating positrons. So the question is, could dark matter be creating positrons? And, you know, this many authors have speculated about different models that it can actually make this true. And so here's just a plot of that, of how smooth this line is now. Okay, so, you know, once again, we don't really know where this is coming from. So, you know, so initially it was postulated that dark matter is not a mass of a WIMP scale, but it's mass of, you know, MeV scale. Okay, and we're just directly annihilating into positrons. Okay, that's really not very well theoretically motivated, but, you know, phenomenologically, you know, why not? You know, constraints have come along on that model. And, you know, for my last slide here, I'll just say, you know, once again, these decaying dark matter models can actually, you know, do something like this as well. Okay, so once again, you can have a scenario where you have a next to lightest particle, which is extremely degenerate with a light particle. You know, it emits two photons, and it also emits two positrons. And you can actually nicely fit sort of the angular distribution of the signal along with, you know, fitting some components of the gamma ray background. So here's a signal from dark matter. And basically what you'd require is a dark matter particle live about 10 to the 20 seconds, which is, you know, 4 orders of magnitude larger than the current age of the universe. And the mass splittings have to be really small, of order 1 MeV. So, you know, these are just sort of speculative signals, but, you know, going back here, like, this is, you know, maybe this is some evidence for dark matter. So this is kind of like what we have to look at. You know, we have to kind of like attack this from all different angles and see, like, you know, what things are telling us as far as, like, the Milky Way, and, you know, what are the best ways to detect this. So so that's sort of the ending speculations, and I guess I'll just end there because I'm probably over. So.
Questions. Who made much of this egret excess that people
Do I make much? You mean that 1G the excess?
Yeah.
I don't make much of it actually because it's hard to model the astrophysical backgrounds in that energy regime. You know, there's actually a long sort of standing tradition of like looking at some diffuse gamma ray background like this, say, or like, you know, this. you know, over MeV sort of energy ranges-ish, or GeV energy ranges, and saying, okay, there's some emission of photons that I don't understand, and you know, I'm going to attribute that to dark matter. You know, it's an interesting sort of speculation. I think, you know, we'll know the story a little bit more with GLAST, and you know, talking to sort of the experts who model this stuff, it's like they know it's like hard to model the emission of gamma rays from the galaxy as far as like the sources, you know, or sources like cosmic rays. You know, what's the main components like Bremsstrahlung, Compton scattering, you know, pi zero scattering. So I don't, you know, short answer is I don't think much of it, but it's interesting to speculate about. Yeah.
Well, I'll ask a very naive question.
Oh, please do.
When you were talking about the cold dark matter model for satellites of the Milky Way, you mentioned that they're likely the earliest forming dark matter halos in the universe.
Yeah.
Doesn't that strike you as odd?
Not necessarily, because basically what happens is, you know, from a physical cosmology perspective, what happens is, you know, you have stars that initially form in the early universe. Okay, so say you have galaxies that form, and then those you have stars that form. Okay, the stars form are eventually going to emit, you know, ultraviolet radiation. Okay, and they're going to do what's called reionize the universe. Okay, so in this process of reionization, which happens at about redshifting, where from, you know, 6 to 10-ish. Okay, after that reionization, basically what happens is it's harder to form these extremely small mass galaxies. Okay, so basically what happens is before reionization, you can form these very easily. Okay, because you know they're not getting battered around by UV photons. Okay, but afterwards, it's actually much harder to form them. Okay, so in that context, that's sort of like a physically motivated reason. I mean, this depends upon a lot of details, and you know, the astrophysics is not completely worked out yet. But you know, it's a physically viable mechanism actually that actually does this. So it's not necessarily weird. In fact, it's almost something to predict in the context of this model. Yeah.
Are you saying the following? If you look back at your graph relevant to that, one sees that the cold dark matter model predicted something like 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more small dwarf galaxies than are observed. So that's a big deal. Are you saying
this is a big deal? Okay, so what this actually tells you is that these guys are sitting there swimming around in the Milky Way. But we have to find a way to detect these in some way.
No. Or are you okay? So I thought what you were saying is that the first ones that get produced, reionization, and that serves as a feedback to prevent later ones from being formed.
Right, exactly.
So is the idea that the actual prediction, taking into account the feedback from reionization, is closer to what's seen?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So this would be something like, you know, one thing that can't be really modeled very well yet. I mean, all you can do is just say, like, cut on some redshift and say, like, dark matter halos that form before then are...
Okay, but if feedback from energy produced in stars and so forth can affect the predictions of cold dark matter models by 2 or 3 orders of magnitude in that energy range, how do you know they don't affect the predictions by 2 or 3 orders of magnitude in other energy ranges? Not in other mass ranges. That's a huge suppression.
What other mass ranges are you talking about? Like anywhere above?
Yeah, I mean, how do I know that the predictions of cold dark matter aren't strongly affected by feedback from formation of lots of stars that supernova very early, et cetera?
They might be, what specific predictions are you referring to, like galaxies at higher gas scale?
It's more a methodological question. I mean, if you're willing to hand wave yourself to suppress predictions of cold dark matter in a mass range of 10 to the 6 to 7 solar masses by a factor of 100 to 1,000, then because the physical effects we know are there, that is formation of stars, ultraviolet light, et cetera, reionization, okay. Then why should I believe the rest of the numerical simulations of cold dark matter that leave out who knows what other effects from?
The question is you have to take a sort of a questioning approach to these, right? This isn't the full story, right? At the end of the day,
right? But then.
So basically, are you asking like why even claim why the crisis or something like that?
If you think that feedback effects can in any mass range suppress the distribution of halos by a factor of 1,000. Okay. Then why should?
But I mean, this is the predictor. I mean, this is the scale. These are the scales over which these effects are predicted to matter.
Sure,
then
don't we have to reconsider everything in the light of the possible effects of feedback on other scales?
You probably do. I mean, there's different feedback mechanisms in different scales. So, and there's really not, the reason why I'm bringing like this particular mechanism is because this is like where the properties of the dark matter actually matter. Okay, so you know, the question is this a matter of, on other scales, it's not a matter of like, is it dark matter physics or is it astrophysics, right? On this scale, it's a matter of, you know, is it, you know, there's definitely a potential with dark matter physics. Okay, so, you know, these are the things that still need to be disentangled.
Yeah.
Okay, so we should thank you again.